This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a hockey player at UW-Madison, Blake Jeffrion seemed to be destined for big things at the highest levels of the game. He had played for Team USA at many levels of youth hockey. He was drafted by an NHL team partway through college, elected to finish 4 years. After his senior year, he won the Hobey Baker Award as the top college hockey player in the country. Hockey was even in his blood. Pro hockey went back 4 generations, including the legendary Bernie Boom Boom Jeffrion, his grandfather. But just a couple years into his pro career, a horrific on-ice injury ultimately put an end to his playing days. A new book shares Blake's story. The author joins us now along with Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you played competitive hockey yourself? What was your experience like in the sport? If you gave a big part of your life to any sport and your playing days ended, what was it like? How did you handle that transition? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sam Jeffries is a freelance writer and communications professional and a UW-Madison graduate. He's author of the book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And legendary UW-Madison hockey star Blake Jeffrion is with us as well. Blake, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Blake, first of all, this book covers some very painful moments in every way of the word in your story. A guy comes up to you and says, I want to write a book about these moments. Did you think twice about wanting to talk about it and relive it?
Yeah, I think my first reaction was, is this guy serious? Out of all the people and all the things in the world you could write a book about, why me? Was actually my knee-jerk and first reaction. But to answer your question more directly, I think everything in this world happens for a reason, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. And I've taken the good, learned from the bad, and kind of moved on. I think that's how I've always been. That's how I was as a player. So when Sam approached me, once I got past it, he was actually real and it wasn't a college buddy messing with me. I was kind of thumbs up and let's do this.
Sam, Blake set up my first question for you. Why Blake? What led you to want to tell his story?
I had gone to Madison and Blake and I overlapped and followed his incredible career, but then followed his pro career after as well and saw that rise and then the tragedy that ended his playing time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was so much additional that I could share and tell and that he really was the Forrest Gump of hockey, that he had been right place, right time for so many moments in the sport for decades. And so I don't think it was that hard of a sell to convince him that there was even more to his story than maybe he realized.
Now, Blake, your earliest memories of hockey, I mentioned Hockey Dynasty, Boom Boom Jeffrion, the inventor of the slap shot. There are stories in the book about you riding your tricycle around in circles, pretending it's a Zamboni. What is your first memory of saying, this is what I want to do? I want to play hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's 3 defining moments that stick out, big time for me. Number one would be, just getting on the ice and understanding that feeling and pushing around a chair and learning how to skate. Two was, the first time, I remember the first time that I actually like scored a goal and the sensation and feeling that ran through my body. And that's when I knew I was a true competitor since a very young age. And then I think 3 was when I was a fairly young kid, I think this story's in the book, I was shooting pucks in the backyard and my grandfather came out, Boom Boom Jeffrion, and he goes, that's not how you shoot the puck. You shoot the puck like this, Dare. And he took my little stick, flipped it over because I was lefty, he was a righty, missed the net and put a hole through my fence. And I remember like watching this puck like saucer perfectly and the whole thing. And then my dad instantly came out like, Dad, what are you doing? I just built that fence. And, after I saw my pappy shoot the puck, I was like, oh man, I want to be that guy. I think those are the 3 defining moments of my early childhood days of wanting to be a hockey player.
And Sam, we just heard that French-Canadian accent of Blake's pappy there. But Blake's growing up in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You talk about this in the book. If at that time I was looking, I was a scout, I was going to find my next hockey star, Tennessee, I wasn't going to start there, right?
Probably not, although hockey had been creeping to Tennessee for a while. And a cool Madison connection, Bob Suter, who was on the Miracle on Ice team and as a Wisconsin native, ended up playing for a minor league team in Nashville back after the Miracle on Ice and before his pro career really took off. So that creep had been going on for a while, but Blake's dad, Danny, and then the entire Jeffreon family drove so much of that, and it really was an incredible thing for him to get drafted by his hometown team and be able to return to Nashville, you know, 10 plus years removed from his Pee Wee days and you know, wear the colors of the hometown NHL team.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffreon and the Fastest Game on Earth, and UW hockey star Blake Jeffreon himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, hockey memories of your own, join in at 800-642-1234. Blake, you have a great teen career going. Some people around the country very curious about where you are going to go to college. What took you to Madison?
Yeah, great question. You know, growing up as a kid, you know, Michigan was always kind of my number one choice, you know, in the South. You know, the only college hockey games we got to see were the Michigan-Michigan State rival games or the national championship game or the Frozen Four. And usually Michigan was always in those games with those cool blue, you know, those blue helmets with the yellow stripes. Always wanted that helmet. And, you know, Red Berenson, who was the coach for a long time there, was a good family friend of ours as well. So I think kind of those two were kind of the number one reasons why I wanted to go there. And really the punchline is, you know, I lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years playing for Team USA and you know, Ann Arbor's great, but I wanted something a little bit more and something, you know, a little bit different. And when I went to Madison and just saw the football game, the small city, although very similar to Ann Arbor around, you know, size, but a little bit bigger, a little bit more of a personality to the town, a little bit more swagger to the town, a great team. And then the ultimate, the Kohl Center. And then Mike Eaves, the head coach there at the time, you know, his assistant, former assistant John Hines, was my head coach at USA. And they had very similar styles of play and the way they looked at the game and you know, and whatnot. And I think when you combine all of that, when I went to Madison, it was just like, oh, and don't forget the infamous college club owned by the Meyer family, because that was a selling point for me. And I think when you combine all of those, I mean, there was nothing that, you know, you wrap in the great education of Wisconsin. I mean, truthfully, I really don't think there's a better, you know, setup or college hockey program in the country. And I mean that, you know, wholeheartedly, not just because I went there. It's pretty hard to beat Madison.
Sam, UW-Madison had at various points been one of the biggest teams in the country, always at or near the top. What were things like by the time that Blake ends up going to UW-Madison for the hockey program in the late 2000s?
Yeah, so Blake comes in on the heels of the 2006 national championship, and both men's and women's team won that year. So it was really a crowning achievement for the program in so many ways. And has to inherit a team with high expectations and then have to deal with his own, no offense, but Blake, but big-headedness that doesn't matter what color the helmet was, probably couldn't fit it on. And it ended up being a struggle for the next couple of years, and really the pathway that I think he found himself and then the team under Mike Eaves found its way back to the national championship in 2010 and really put together an incredible run that culminated in so many ways in those Mike Eaves years.
Blake, actually, let's talk about that. Sam writes about this in the book. There were a couple points in your career and a couple big ones in college where you switched your approach to the game and became more of a student of the game, more team focused. Can you talk about what changed your attitude and led to a lot of your success?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think as an 18-year-old kid being drafted as a first round, a first pick, second round of your hometown team, coming off a world championship, entering college where the team that you're going to just won, coming off the national championship and hanging out with those guys and seeing what they're like and whatnot, and then going into freshman year, being like, oh, this is going to be a cakewalk. Like, you know, as Sam alluded to, you know, I was big-headed, arrogant, and the whole thing, as I think any 18-year-old kid would be. You know, and look, I had to learn and grow up and mature, and that while I was a talented guy, I wasn't the most, it didn't come naturally to me. And the core competency of why I was a good player was my work ethic, first and foremost. And if I wasn't working hard, a lot of other things weren't working, if at all. And, you know, I think it, just like anything in life, you go through, you know, iterations of as a player and as a person that you need to kind of, once the season ended, I always would reflect and what I do well, what I do bad, what I need to improve on, what I need to get back to, what I need to learn from, and whatnot. And I think, you know, freshman year was a very humbling experience for me. And, you know, I got back to my core of, you know, not worrying about the extracurricular activities and, you know, focusing on the game and hockey and just working hard and then evolving from there and just keep getting better and better every year. You know, I think is the core of it.
We're talking to former pro hockey player and Badger star Blake Jeffrion, also with us Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up, we'll talk about the injury that ended Blake's career just a few years into his pro stint, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a fan recently or for a long time of the UW hockey program? Did you yourself pour a lot of time and energy into playing a certain sport when those days ended? What did it mean to you? Join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Blake Jeffrion, former Wisconsin Badger hockey star, professional hockey player, and Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, Blake, I want to take you now a couple years into your pro career. You've played with that hometown team in Nashville, traded to the Montreal Canadiens. It's the strike season. You're playing with the minor league team. What might look like a routine moment in hockey changed your life. If you're willing to, can you share your experience of that moment and what you remember of it and what came after?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember it was we were playing a game in the Bell Center. It was during the lockouts. We wanted to give something to the fans. I was playing for the Montreal Canadiens minor league team. My mom and dad flew up. They were actually in Boston watching my brothers play and then drove up to Montreal to watch me. It was a couple shifts into the first period. And, you know, puck turned over inside the blue line of our own end. I turned it up and, you know, was going on the boards, tried to jump out of the way of a hip check. And long and short is, you know, his skate went one way, my shoulder went the other, or head went the other, kind of skate came up and hit me right in the side of the head. You know, I had suffered a lot of concussions in my career, both, you know, very, very minor to all of being knocked out and unconscious. So, I'd known what a concussion felt like, and I'd known if I'd had one. And after that collision happened, which was a hard collision, I definitely thought I did, but when I, you know, as a when that happens to me, usually my peripheral vision goes. So it looks like you're, you know, it seems as if you're looking down, like, look, you have two straws you're looking down. It's kind of the best way to describe it. And I didn't have that. So I was sitting on my knees and, you know, kind of waiting for a second. And then, you know, of course, a fight breaks out, or, you know, a scrummish or scrum breaks out. And then, you know, I kind of stood up, I sat back, put my head up, and I just felt like a warm sensation go down my back, which was a bunch of blood. And then I was like, oh man, I gotta get off the ice. So I skated off the ice with my head kind of over, you know, and I get to the trainer's room, or I'm sorry, get to the bench where my trainers met with a towel. You know, he puts it up. I go into the trainer's room. They don't know where I'm kind of bleeding from. And long story short is I had a pretty severe cut on the side of my head, and they, looked at it and it kind of disappeared very quickly. Mind you, these guys all are speaking in French, so I don't know what they're saying whatsoever. And they come flying back 100 miles an hour with the doctor. The doctor says, you know, something very quickly in French. And everything started moving very quickly from there on out. You know, next thing I know, my mom and dad are down there. I'm in a stretcher, and I'm off to the hospital. You know, the last memory I had before I went unconscious was, you know, I went into the hospital in a stretcher, looking up into those, you know, one of those rooms that's really cold. And, you know, I passed out. And the punchline there is I had a suppressed skull fracture and internal bleeding on my brain, which caused me to kind of, you know, go unconscious. Mm. So that was the last thing I remember until I woke up. You know, I don't remember how many hours, but a lot of hours later. So,
and Sam, I'm not an athlete. I'm a parent of athletes, not at Blake's level. My first thought was his parents are there, right? And when you see your kid down, you don't know what's happened. You talk to Blake's family members about their experience. Could you talk about how they talked about that moment?
Yeah, and it was really one of the amazing things for the Jeffreyon family to be so open with me. His mom, Kelly, who's a tremendous storyteller, walked me through being in the stands and I think being a little casual when it first happened because they have Blake is not their only son. They all play hockey. They've seen
injuries their share before. Of injuries. Yeah.
That's right. They've seen injuries. They've seen concussions. And I remember her telling me, first thought was, another concussion. And kind of, you know, girding themselves for that recovery. And it wasn't until being in the hospital and having to rush Blake to surgery that they really understood that this time was different and the seriousness of it, speaking French or not, that really came through very quickly. And so she was open and transparent and then had to, unfortunately, be the one to make the call to Blake's fiance at the time, and his now wife, Kaylin. And Kaylin was taking a night off from law school, having a well-deserved break with friends, and gets the call, not having in her mind Blake's playing schedule, not knowing where and when the game was that night, and you know, immediately fell to her knees and broke down and really described being near catatonic, traveling from Chicago to Montreal to be with him bedside. So it was and everyone I talked to, there was a real delayed reaction. I think nobody understood the danger or the risks, and then I spoke to the surgeon and the trainer, and I think for the medical side, they all understood very quickly how bad this was, how close he was to do something far more severe than what happened, and how lucky it was that there was no NHL that night, because they actually had the best in the business sitting there ringside ready to help.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffreyon and the Fastest Game on Earth, and Blake Jeffreyon himself, former pro and UW-Madison hockey player. Blake, there's a moment in the book after this injury, the recovery, it takes time, it's difficult, and you're evaluating hockey and the thought might be, do you make a comeback, do you not? And it seems like you're asking yourself, even before the injury, was it worth it? Is this where I want to be? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, look, I think, you know, I had suffered 13 documented concussions in my career. We all know the short-term and long-term effects of concussions or what's out there. And, I had spoken to a lot of people, both former players, current players, neurologists. I mean, anyone and everyone, you pretty much name it, I had spoken to. And what the common theme that kept coming back was, Blake, it's actually, it's scientifically proven that it's not actually as a big of a deal if you suffer a lot of concussions. It's around two core competencies, and that is, number one, does the time period that you're out continue to get longer and longer? Is the first and foremost question you have to ask yourself. And then secondly, how often are they occurring, inside that? And I would say, historically, when I had suffered a concussion, I was usually back within, a couple of days to a week, feeling pretty much ready to go. And I would say my last two concussions that I had suffered previously were fairly within reach of each other. And both of those were, I was out longer term, and they were, each of those consecutively were longer durations of being out. And then when you suffer something like this, it's actually, substantially worse than a concussion, obviously. And, it's actually, a bruise to your brain. Everyone was just like, look, dude, you can go, first of all, if you can find a doctor to let you play and is willing to assume liability, by all means, best of luck to you on that one. But secondly, like, there's no way that you can, that you should come back and play. You should move on, live a long and happy life, and not have, you know, long-term effects associated with this, and go do something else. And, you know, so it was kind of writing on the wall, and that's how I'd always kind of made every decision, was kind of, you know, if you talk to enough people, usually you get a gut feeling around it, the right decision to make, and or it kind of slaps you in the face on what you should do in life. You know, turn to the ones you're closest with and people that know the most about that industry. And I think after I did that, it was kind of, you know, the writing was on the wall. It was time for me to step away and go do something else.
You did continue to work in hockey. You did some time as a scout and into management. You still love the game?
I still do love the game. You know, as you said, you know, I went on to be a scout, and as I like to call it, a road warrior, and then into management. But, you know, ultimately, you know, still love the game, still watch it. I just made a bet with my dad over the weekend that I still think Connor McDavid will lead the NHL in scoring this year. It's nice that he's got 11 points in his last three games. No, I still love the game, still follow pretty closely. I have a lot of friends that still play. But, you know, going through all this, I think the one thing that I've found is that family and friends are most important to me. And I was no longer willing to sacrifice those relationships in exchange for the game of hockey. So moved on to do something else.
And we'll leave it there. Blake, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me. And Sam, as always, pal, good to see you. And thanks for writing the book, pal.
Yeah. And Sam, thanks for being with us.
Yeah. I'm grateful for the time and excited to hear what people think. It was a special journey to be able to write it and something else to have it out in the world and for Blake's kids and my own to be able to read it one day.
We've been talking to former pro hockey player and UW-Madison star Blake Jeffrion and author Sam Jeffries. Sam's new book is called Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, as winter weather settles in around Wisconsin, get a lot of perspectives on the latest efforts to solve the problem of homelessness in the state. Governor Evers will join the show, as well as lawmakers from both parties. And you could join in with what you're seeing when it comes to homelessness in your own community, maybe in your own life. You can start the conversation right now with an email at ideas@wpr.org. Then join Kate and her guests. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever watched Sesame Street with your kids or as a kid, you've probably seen Cookie Monster with a cookie, eating the cookie, air quotes around eating, since he can't actually swallow them, and crumbs just fly all over the place. You might have wondered, are those real cookies? The answer is sort of, but you wouldn't want to eat them. The New York Times tackled the question. Apparently, multiple people have asked over the years. Somebody actually bakes cookies for Cookie Monster. They used rice cakes for a while. That didn't work so good. The recipe includes things like pancake mix, puffed rice, grape nuts, and instant coffee. Okay, weird cookies, but you can eat that stuff. But wait, the chocolate chips are made with hot glue sticks. So they're not chocolate. They're just colored bits of glue. Oh yeah, along with no chocolate, there's no oil, no fat, no sugar. All those things could stain Cookie Monster. The key is not to make a delicious cookie, it's to make something that's easy to clean up after and blows up easily into lots of crumbs. When it comes down to it, C is for cookie. That good enough for me. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn how a flood of cheap guns brought into the U.S. after World War II changed the way we bought and talked about firearms. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about leaving home and finding a new one nearby.
Wisconsin is one of 12 states that requires Native American content to be taught in schools. That prompted Maria Novotny to reach out to WPR's Wisconsin Project, asking us how educators are teaching this in the classroom. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, schools are working to integrate indigenous histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty into the curriculum. In a Madison West High School classroom, students take their seats in their first period class. This morning, they're talking about news involving the Cherokee Nation and the push to have First Nation representation in Congress. One by one, students like senior Abby O'Callahan share their questions.
given the legacy of the federal government and its involvement in the dispossession of Native peoples, how can we move forward at both the local and the state level to kind of make sure that there's a real change in policy?
The class is just one example of how students are connecting the histories of Wisconsin's First Nations to the present day. And it wasn't too long ago that legislation known as Act 31 spurred this education. Since 1991, the law has mandated that public schools and public and private universities teach the histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty of tribal nations in Wisconsin. It was in response to the violence that erupted in northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. Members of the Ojibwe tribe were spearfishing, and protesters blocked them from exercising a treaty right they reserved. J.P. Leary is of Cherokee descent. He's an associate professor of First Nations Studies at UW-Green Bay. He wrote a book about Act 31.
The real policy problem that Act 31 is addressing is the lack of meaningful opportunities to learn accurate, authentic information about the federally recognized tribes and bands in Wisconsin.
David O'Connor agrees. He's a consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. O'Connor is a member of the Ojibwe tribe and offers educators resources about Wisconsin's First Nations on topics like treaty rights, indigenous languages, and festivities. He encourages educators to weave those lessons into subjects beyond social studies.
If you teach it from a tribal sovereignty lens first, you could teach Native histories and cultures 10 times easier.
Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribal nations. Teachers like Jeff Ryan of Prescott High School have been working to integrate Native histories more deeply into their lessons. Since 2000, the social studies teacher has taken hundreds of students on a four-day trip to the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation in northern Wisconsin. They talk with tribal elders, do craft work, and tour cultural sites.
To gain a full understanding of the experience, whether it be the history or the contemporary issues connected to Native people, you have to access and talk with Native people.
There are more than 500 tribal nations in the U.S. Ryan and his students discuss what that means.
500 ways of thinking, 500 ways of talking, 500 ways of living, 500 ways of being.
Some critics say Act 31 has no teeth. The law requires the subject matter to be taught at least three times in grades K through 12. But since Wisconsin is a local control state, it's up to school boards and administrators to implement curriculum. Since its passage, more resources have become available for teachers to use. Even so, O'Connor says that for some educators, it's their first time learning the content. Sometimes it contradicts what they were taught.
For far too long, I always think that First Nations peoples and communities have been seen in curriculum as always long ago and far away, rather than being contemporary.
O'Connor says he hopes more schools make teaching Native histories a priority because, as he says, failing to do so is a lost opportunity for all.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on First Nations education in Wisconsin's classrooms. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Americans own almost half of all the civilian-held firearms in the world. Our ratio of guns to people is more than twice that of any country, and gun sales set records in recent years. It wasn't always that way. In the years after World War II, cheap surplus weapons flooded the U.S. market and started to be marketed and sold like other mass consumer goods. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of that boom in guns and how our cultural attitudes around them changed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the history of guns and gun culture in the Cold War era and since then, in your lifetime, have you seen a change in the way we talk about guns and the Second Amendment? And how about gun availability, accessibility, and prices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew McKevitt is the John D. Winters Endowed Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University. He's the author of Consuming Japan, Popular Culture and the Globalizing of 1980s America. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
You write in Gun Country that a lot of people, when they're talking about guns and history in America, they go back to the founders and the crafting of the Second Amendment and the 1800s. You see much more recent key turning points, starting with the end of World War II. Can you tell a little bit about that history of, you know, Europe in particular, clogged with surplus weapons and how they find their way to the United States?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the United States has always been a gun country of some sort. But what I argue in the book is that we really become the gun country after the Second World War. And what makes that happen is a number of changes to gun capitalism, to the way guns are marketed, to the way guns are consumed. And the story I focus on is in the aftermath of the Second World War, the incredible availability of cheap firearms from Europe and from Asia. These guns were war surplus weapons. Many of them were rifles used on battlefields in Europe and Asia during the war. And what happens in the beginning of the late 1940s and the early 1950s is we get a whole cohort of what I call gun capitalists who are really entrepreneurs looking to make connections between surging American demand for consumer goods, not just firearms, but all kinds of consumer goods in the post-war United States, which is flourishing as a result of post-war prosperity, and the availability of these cheap firearms. So I write about a number of figures, like the most important of which is a man named Sam Cummings, who creates a company called InterArms, who, beginning in the 1950s, imports hundreds of thousands of war surplus rifles into the United States each year. And these are really cheap guns that drive down the price of guns and increase the availability. And I think we can chart a lot of our gun culture and gun consumerism to that moment.
And you write that guns, I don't think these days we think of them as a consumer product, even though I guess they clearly are. This really was a transformative moment where, you know, someone might have a gun. They might be able to afford one. Now there's cheap guns, starter guns, and they became a consumer item like a washing machine, except you only want one washing machine. How did this change the way we thought?
Yeah, they're consumer goods, right? I mean, they're like the Beanie Babies for men of the 1950s or something like that. It becomes a thing to collect, and it's cheapness that enables that. A brand new, well-made quality hunting rifle in 1955 might have cost you $120-$150 in 1950s dollars, which is something on the scale of, you know, $1,500 today. And that's really expensive for today and for people at the time. And so those were not really sort of entry-level weapons. What gun capitalists like Sam Cummings do is they make incredibly cheap firearms available to more people. So that the equivalent of that $150 rifle is the $10 Carcano rifle that Cummings sells. And this is a rifle made in Italy during the war and imported by the hundreds of thousands in the 1950s and into the 1960s. And this is the very weapon that in 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald will use to shoot John F. Kennedy. And so these cheap guns become collector's items. They prompt a growing kind of consumer market among especially men in the United States, and they're marketed to men as things to collect. That's one of the hallmarks of advertising from this era, is to just display the bounty of guns available and to advertise them as sort of the reward for American sacrifice during the war. You went out and you won the war, and one of your rewards is you get the guns, because this is the only consumer market really in the world where so many guns could be sold.
Another turning point comes in the 1960s, the rise of the civil rights movement, and then riots, especially in 1967 in places like Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. You talk about breathless media reports talking about organized bands of snipers that didn't exist, to be clear. But people start to think about their guns in a different way through this period of unrest. What starts to change?
Yeah, so this is, we have this consumer market there of plenty in the 1950s and the 1960s, and Americans become accustomed to that seemingly limitless access to the world's weapons of war. But beginning really in 1963 with Kennedy's assassination, there is a legislative movement to do something about it. In the U.S. Congress, it's focused on the in the Senate on a figure named Thomas Dodd, who's a senator from Connecticut, who runs the Senate's Juvenile Delinquency Subcommittee, and he's doing investigations throughout the 1960s. What's also happening, of course, in parallel is the splintering of the Black Freedom Movement and increasing tensions in cities and Black uprisings against police brutality, against lack of economic opportunity. And so when you combine this consumer market that has seemed limitless for more than a decade with increasing white anxieties about Black uprisings, and throw into the mix the possibility of gun restrictions coming from U.S. Congress, you get a surge in gun buying. 1967 and 68 is really in some ways it's an echo of 2020 and 2021. With the surge in gun buying we saw as a consequence of the pandemic, of anxieties about another Black freedom movement, this time the Black Lives Matter uprisings of 2020, of a contentious presidential election you have in 1968 and in 2020 as well. And so you see what is essentially panic buying of guns. In 1967 and 68 is an incredible spike in gun buying. And because of all those imports that had been flooding in since the mid-1950s, there's plenty for people to go out and buy.
What does this end up meaning for, you know, if we compared 1938, say pre-World War II, and then coming out of the 60s and 70s, how did we look at our guns differently?
Well, they are seen as items of personal self-defense and a mass level in ways that they weren't so much in the 1930s. There is a wave of gun regulations in the 1930s coming out of the New Deal, mostly targeted at what's seen as the sort of gangland violence of the era. So we get 1934, the National Firearms Act, 1938, the Federal Firearms Act. And guns are, especially things like handguns, are seen at a popular level as kind of tools of criminals. People are seen as sort of suspicious if they need to carry a handgun. But by the 1960s and 1970s, handguns especially are marketed as tools of self-defense. And with the gun control movement of the 1960s, especially the legislative movement coming out of Congress, moving through the Senate and eventually producing the Gun Control Act of 1968, what that also creates is a grassroots gun rights movement, a movement of people organizing at the local level, not just at the NRA, because the NRA is kind of a little slow to get to this. But we get this grassroots gun rights movement that is organizing around this idea that firearms are for self-defense, and especially things like handguns, because it is, as much as we focus on kind of the big name rifles and so-called assault weapons and so forth, it's always been handguns that have caused more violence in the United States. And so that idea that the individual has a right to own something like a handgun for personal self-defense, independent of service in a militia or defense of the country, that really emerges as a mass popular idea at this moment out of this cauldron of stuff happening in the 1960s.
We're talking to Drew McKevitt, professor of history at Louisiana Tech University. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I want to put a shout out for the women as part of this culture. I'm a baby boomer, World War II Madison West graduate, and in the 1950s and 60s, for us it was a lot of the TV culture. I mean, the bloodless cowboy programs and Gunsmoke, and I was insane about Davy Crockett. I have one Kentucky line, so I think I identified with the frontier. Also, there were no organized sports for girls in our high school in the 1960s, except one, which I think was the Victory Club holdover from World War II. And so we all joined Girls Rifle Club, and I became a sharpshooter.
Interesting, Kate. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Drew. It was a cultural, I don't know, there's a cultural way of thinking about guns, recreational, pop culture. What do you think?
Yeah, no doubt in the 1950s. I think, I forget what the number was, but at some point in the late 1950s, 8 of the top 10 TV shows were Westerns of that sort, right? And so, in fact, one of the things that Thomas Dodd's committee is going to focus on in the early 1960s is they're going to hold hearings on the role of guns in popular entertainment. And I think rightfully so, lots of witnesses come before the committee and they say this is sort of bunk, this idea that Westerns and so forth make people go out and commit crimes. But certainly it contributed to the popularity of gun ownership, not in a criminal sense, but more in a sort of mass popular consumer sense. And so it makes perfect sense that we have rifle clubs in the 1960s, and especially rifle clubs for girls too, especially in rural areas outside of cities or in growing suburbs.
Thanks for the call, Kay. Talking to Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country. Back to your calls. Keith is with us in Kewaunee. Keith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Whenever we try to get any legislation work going on gun control of some type, it seems like you hear a lot of things about the Second Amendment rights, but it doesn't seem like you ever hear anything about the first three words of the Second Amendment, which are a well-regulated militia. And I guess wondering what the author's take is on Second Amendment and where a well-regulated militia fits into guns.
Keith, thanks for the call. Drew?
Yeah, I think of myself as a Second Amendment absolutist in the sense that I want to adhere to all 27 words of the Second Amendment. And those first three are just as important as the last 13, a well-regulated militia. When historians write about the Second Amendment, they write about the importance of the militia to Madison's formulation of the Second Amendment and to the eventual passage of the Second Amendment in 1791. And so there's no question among historians, there's a very clear consensus among historians that the Second Amendment was about the relationship between the state, that being individual states and a federal government, and how an armed populace factored into that relationship. The amendment had nothing to do with individual gun ownership, which was something that at the time nobody would have really questioned anyway, because there was a general assumption that an individual had a right to own a firearm. There were state constitutions that protected those things, and there was even English common law that had recognized it in a number of ways. But what's happened in the last several decades is that we've had a very aggressive, concerted intellectual and legal effort to define the Second Amendment as a statement of an individual right, and to use those first three words to sort of push those first three words out and pretend as if they had nothing to do with the individual's right to own firearms. And that's not something that historians would agree with.
Keith, thanks a lot for the call. Drew, you point out repeatedly in your book, the United States stands out in the world, most of the world, when it comes to gun laws, very few of them, very loosely regulated. And in terms of gun violence, what do you hope, by looking at this history that you tell in Gun Country, what do you hope we can take from that and learn lessons from to reduce gun violence here in the United States in the future?
Yeah, you know, it was, I try not to be cynical about this history, because there's a moment in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy's killed and Martin Luther King had been killed a couple months earlier, and Lyndon Johnson appoints a commission. Lyndon Johnson loved appointing commissions. He appoints another one. It comes to be known as the Eisenhower Commission. The Eisenhower Commission is going to look into violence across American history and in American society. And they appoint a firearms task force that says that is the first federal initiative to look into American gun ownership, American gun culture, American gun violence. And they come to a number of really startling conclusions. And one of the conclusions they came to at that moment, 55 years ago, was we have too many guns. And they were talking about a country of 90 million guns at that point, and maybe 180 million people or so. They said, we have too many guns, and if we don't do something about it right now with the 90 million guns we have, it's going to be too late 25 years from now because we'll have 200 million. And then in another 25 years, we'll have 400 million. If we don't do something right now, we are going to miss this opportunity. And we missed that opportunity. And so today, you know, it's hard to look at this history and to think that we are ever going to do anything to reduce the civilian stockpile in the United States. And so I take hope in the, you know, the gun safety movement that emphasizes things like red flag laws and enhanced background checks, because I don't think ultimately we're going to do anything to reduce that stockpile. Instead, we've just got to figure out ways to keep ourselves safe from that stockpile.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Andrew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, podcasting is in the midst of a major shakeup this year. An audio industry expert breaks down what's going on in the podcast world and where the industry might be headed next. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on The Ideas Network.